that soon is a hymn to your grace. When the music swells, I'm touching your hand. It tells that you're standing near, and at the sound heaven open.
Okay, good evening, everybody.
Portals to
we're
me.
Ready to go. Can I'd like to call this meeting to order. This is the meeting of the Goleta Planning Commission for Monday, April 24th, 2023. We'll stand for the Pledge of Allegiance.
But I always knew I would.
Next, we'll have a roll call of the Planning Commission.
Commissioner Miller is absent. Commissioner Fullerton?
Here.
Commissioner Chapman?
Here.
Vice Chair Maynard?
Here.
And Chair Smith?
Here. Okay, and next we have the public forum. And this is a time where the public has an opportunity to comment on any item that's not on our regular, on tonight's agenda. Do we have anyone wishing to speak for public comment?
There are any members of the public on the Zoom webinar, if you would please use the raise hand feature and I will call on you. I do not see any responses.
Thank you. And yeah, for other members of the public who are present, if you do wish to speak on other items that are on tonight's agenda, that'll come later. And on that note, do we have any amendments or adjustments to the agenda?
Madam Chair, we do not.
Okay. Well, we'll begin with, let's see, we have no administrative agenda this evening, so we'll move on to B, our public hearing. Will the clerk please read this item for the record?
Item B1, consideration of Title 17 Zoning Amendments Ordinance and determination that the ordinance is exempt from the California Environmental Quality Act.
Thank you. And so I believe we'll begin tonight with a presentation from staff. Is there a recommendation for how we should proceed with our public hearing?
Yes, and I'll kick us off. Hello, welcome to this public hearing for the Title 17 Amendments Ordinance Adoption Recommendation to the City Council. I'm Ann Wells, Advanced Planning Manager, and I'm accompanied by Andy Newkirk, Senior Planner in the Advanced Planning Division of the Planning Department. And, of course, the other team, the City Attorney's Office, Peter Imhoff, the Planning Director. Just a little couple administrative things before we get into that presentation. The ordinance that's proposed for amending Title 17, that's from the Goleta Municipal Code. It's provided as Exhibit A to Attachment 1 of the staff report. So if you're looking for that, that's where you'll find it. And then we also included underlined strike-through of the amendments in Attachment 2 of the staff report, and that's in table format, so you can refer to it there. And then I also wanted to flag that we did receive some public comment on the item, and it's posted online with the staff report packet. And some of the comments relate to items not on the agenda, like the housing element, and there were some requested changes for the housing element, and that will get handled separately through a separate process. And then some of the comments relate to items that were not included in the packet. They were not topics that we evaluated and analyzed and worked through and presented in the staff report. And then another comment letter was in support of the amendments, but of course all of
the items can be discussed just because it wasn't included in the packet. I just wanted to flag that. All right, so on the slide two, I'll just hop into it because you've seen this, most of this slide before. We adopted Title 17 in 2020, and that was originally called the New Zoning Ordinance. And since it took effect on April 3rd, 2020, and we've gone through three rounds of adoption of kind of maintenance type amendments, like cleanups, minor revisions, as we're using the zoning, we're kind of tweaking things and tightening things up. And now we're back for the fourth round of amendments that was anticipated. And the amendments are, again, explained in the staff report, and they include addressing potential inconsistencies with state law, so they're broken down. I mean, we tried to bundle the amendments so that they kind of made sense. And then another one is to implement a recently adopted housing element that specifically requires changes to Title 17, so we'll go over those. And then some minor and cleanup revisions that we'll probably always have. We do these kind of maintenance amendments on like about 6 month intervals. So that's it for the kind of background on the code amendments. And for the format that you asked about, Chair, if you agree, we'll continue with the presentation and then take commission questions and then follow that up with public comment and then deliberation, and then take action on the recommendation.
That is agreeable to me. Does that work for my commissioners? Wonderful.
All right, so Mr. Newkirk's gonna dive into and give you a bit of detail about the amendments, and we'll just let him jump into the state law consistency items.
So, Chair Smith and Planning Commissioners, we really have three sets of topics to go over, the more kind of substantive changes that we're proposing. The first is kind of general state law consistency, not related to our housing element. And the first of these is electrical vehicle charging stations. This is something we've tweaked before, but after relooking at the state regulations, we identified a couple little changes that we think we needed to make. Kind of broadly speaking, we have very limited land use authority over electrical vehicle charging stations. It's primarily just building code compliance. There's very limited circumstances in which those types of development would kick over into our zoning process. But where they do, one of the things in state law is any kind of permit approval needs to be appealable to the Planning Commission, and we had previously prepared those standards for with a zoning clearance. Zoning clearances are non-appealable, so that means it wouldn't be appealable to Planning Commission, so we changed that to a land use permit. So that permit would be then appealable to Planning Commission without having to create a separate whole process for this type of development. And then there's some information, this is pretty nuanced, but about exactly how we would make a finding for denial. And so we included specific reference to the building official playing a role, even though this would be a land use permit, the building official would still have to be involved in that determination. So those are just two little cleanup items. The next item is hydrogen fueling stations, and we only really noticed this. There's a law that got passed in 2022 that added on to this part of state law regulating electrical vehicle charging stations to add in hydrogen fueling stations, which unlike EV charging stations, which is just kind of put in a parking lot of some other use, hydrogen fueling station is really a standalone use comparable to a gas station. And there are certain limitations in state law on how we regulate those. So we added in a new use in the use classifications and added this use to the use tables in part two of the zoning code and added specific standards. They're really just mirroring what we have the right to regulate and where they can go under the state law. So there's really nothing in there that we have leeway on. It's really pretty spelled out in this new state law. So we're actually getting caught up with that. The next item is solar energy systems. And if you see a theme here, there's a lot on kind of renewable energy, cleaner energy, electrification. Solar energy systems, we had standards in our zoning code for solar energy systems, but we think they really need to be updated. We think the rules in state law are very similar, if not identical, to electrical vehicle charging stations. So we essentially took that EV charging station section and copy and pasted it in to where we had our previous solar energy systems. And again, very limited authority to deny solar energy systems. So solar installations, there's extremely limited circumstances. Really has to be that a discrete health and safety impact of that system. And there would have to be findings to go with that. So these are really just cleanups to get us in line with some old state law and some new state law on that, those kind of electrification and cleaner energy. And then the fourth is no net loss funding. This is really a housing law, but it's in this group because it's actually not something we spelled out in our housing element, but we think it's still worth putting in our zoning code. And this has to do with our sites inventory in our housing element. So those sites we're showing to provide capacity for our arena. If there's development on one of those sites that doesn't include the residential units that we assumed in our sites inventory, we need to make a finding with that project to say whether there's adequate remaining sites or not in our sites inventory. It is not a grounds for denial of a project. They're not obligated to meet our assumptions in the housing element, but we have to acknowledge that. And if there are not adequate sites, so if that finding states that we don't have adequate remaining sites, we need to then take action, I believe within 6 months, to find additional sites. So we wanted to put that in our zoning code. It's a requirement of state law. We have to do it, but we wanted to kind of double up and include that in our own zoning code to improve transparency, and so that we at the local level can point to the requirements and it'll cross-reference the government code, just kind of as good governance practice on that pretty important requirement as we move forward through our housing cycle. So the next group is a larger one, and that has to do with housing implementation. We recently adopted our housing element for the sixth cycle, and there are quite a few items in there that require zoning amendments. And so we tried to jump on a lot of these where the amendment is really pretty spelled out in the housing element where we're gonna go with the amendments. A lot of them are just essentially restating state law, kind of like the no net loss requirement. And so we wanted to bring these forward and get these updated so that we can kind of move forward with implementation as seen in the housing element. So the first one is how we calculate residential density. We have maximum residential standards for the zones that we allow housing in. And currently in Title 17, or our zoning code in the municipal code, we require the calculation to be based on the net lot area. And so that means before you calculate the density, you cut out things like ESHA and easements and various other areas that are constrained for development. And that can severely limit the development potential for residential on the site. There's certainly concern that we don't want to impact those areas of concern with the development. However, the things like ESHA setbacks, ESHA buffers, those still apply no matter how you calculate this density. So the way we're moving this is you use the net lot area, but you still have to adhere to all the other standards. It doesn't get you out of those other standards. Perhaps it means smaller units to fit within the confines of the developable area, but it seemed to kind of limit, perhaps unnecessarily, the development potential. And we listed out in the staff report all the kind of areas of concern, the different things we want to look at when we look at density. And that's the staff report kind of lays out how we cover all those things in different places. So it's not as if going to, using net lot area is the only way in which we can ensure things like, you know, ESHA standards are protected. They're in the code. So they will still get applied to the project, but this gives an opportunity to get that maximum residential development potential on a lot. The second item is try that again. Maybe turn it off, turn it on again. So the second item is replacement of lost units, and I should give you for the density calculation, that's HE, the first bullet, that's HE2, subprogram 2.1E, where we got that from, what we're implementing there. For replacement of units lost in redevelopment, that's HE 2.1F, and this is strictly from state law. And essentially, if you have a new housing development or a new development that comes in and as a result of the development removes deed-restricted lower-income units, those have to be made up, essentially. So we want to get more housing, but we don't want to lose the deed restrict. This is the theory here, is we don't want to lose that lower income housing that we already have. So, we're going to protect that. And that's just, again, a state law requirement that we're adding into our own code. The third item is sites identified for lower income housing in a prior housing element. This is from subprogram HE2.1G. And this is, again, a requirement of state law where if a site has been used in previous housing elements, they then qualify moving forward for streamlined ministerial review. And so we talked about this a little bit during the housing element adoption process. For vacant sites, it's two or more previous housing cycles. And for underutilized or non-vacant sites, it's one previous housing cycle. So currently, this won't apply to any underutilized sites because we haven't used them in prior housing cycles. But there are a handful of vacant sites now that will qualify for that streamlined ministerial review. So that'll be under Chapter 1744, our objective design standards, as well as any objective development standards that are elsewhere in the code. But again, that's required under state law, so there's really no wiggle room. We're just restating what we already must apply under state law. The next item from a housing element implementation is live-work uses, and this is implementing subprogram HE2.2C to support diversity of housing types. And this is to remove, primarily to remove the conditional use permit requirement for live-work units. This is seen as a commercial use, so these are in commercial zones, and to shift that permit approval to a land use permit. And we didn't say in the housing element it would be a land use permit, but that we'd remove the conditional use permit requirement. So we put in the land use permit requirement because there are quite a few standards we want to cross-reference. And we did amend some of those specific use standards in Chapter 1741. And those are just to things like the configuration, just kind of fine-tuning those requirements a little bit to make what we think makes a little more sense for this type of use that we're supportive of in our housing element. The next set of amendments for the housing element implementation come from Program 3, and that's really about fair housing and special needs housing and the need to accommodate special needs housing in our city. So the first item there is emergency shelters, and that's from subprogram HE3.2B, if I can read my handwriting. And so there's a couple of revisions here. One that was specifically called out in the housing element is we can't require parking for those residing at the emergency shelter. So this is kind of short-term housing for those in need of shelter, right? Under state law, you can't require housing for those who are staying at the shelter. So we just removed that from the parking requirement. So there's still a requirement for the employees tied to the number of employees on site, but we had to remove that kind of the second part of the parking standards. And we revisited the use standards that we already had in our code. There were a few, as we were relooking at the emergency shelter state law limitations, there's only a handful of topic areas in which the city can regulate, and you see those in Chapter 1741. And looking back at those, we thought there were a couple that needed to be removed, including the types of kind of facilities on site. That's not something called out in state law that we had in there. We removed the hours of operation requirement. It just said it may operate 24 hours, but that's like a permissive. It's not really a standard. It's permissive. And that's not mentioned in state law, so that was removed. And then some of the site design requirements were removed. We can have some site design requirements, but felt that some of them were not listed in state law, so we thought it was appropriate to remove those. The next item is low barrier navigation centers. So this is implementing subprogram HE3.2C. This is a brand new use in our zoning code. We haven't previously had this in Title 17, and this is a fairly recent addition in state law. So this is kind of similar to supportive housing where there's on-site support, but this is intended for a shorter duration, where supportive housing is meant for longer duration. So that's where kind of the difference, there's some nuances in these types of uses. But we wanted to add that. Again, we committed to that in the housing element. So there's a new use added. So new use in the use classification section, a few definitions needed to be added to 1773. And then we listed this in the use tables in part two and had specific use standards in 1741. So a new section there, but they really do mirror what we can regulate for this use in state law. So this wasn't something that staff kind of workshopped internally to bring to you. It's really what the state law says we can regulate. Moving on, supportive housing is the next item, and this comes from subprogram HE3.2D. And like I mentioned, it's similar to low barrier navigation centers where it's people kind of transitioning from homelessness eventually to permanent housing, but where there's on-site support. Supportive housing is meant to be more longer duration, not as short of a type of stay at the facility. We did have mention to supportive housing in Title 17, but as part of this implementation, it's really to add much more detail into Title 17 so it's clear what the rules are without having to rely on state law. So we added a use standard section in 1741 for supportive housing, detailing again, there's one item that we can talk about in terms of flexibility locally, but for the most part, we really have limited flexibility. And generally speaking, supportive housing, we have to process ministerial with objective standards. That's one of the key items with supportive housing. As noted on the slide, what we proposed has no limit on the number of units in a supportive housing project to qualify for ministerial review. That's the one area of this section we have flexibility. We can cap that ministerial review at projects with 50 units or less. But we didn't propose that, at least initially, but we wanted to flag that for you, that that's something Planning Commission could recommend we include for City Council review. And as stated in the staff report, and we didn't include this because the city was supportive of the Super 8 supportive housing project, which had more than 50 units. So we thought as an initial measure, we wouldn't include that cap as we were supportive of that project that was larger, that went through actually less than ministerial review is exempt because of the funding source. But we did want to flag that as that's one very narrow area where we have some authority to have a local standard. Moving on to large residential care facilities, this is implementing subprogram HE 3.2E, and so residential care facilities are again a special needs housing type, but it's broken into two categories, small and large, and that has to do with the number of individuals served at the site. And so small is 6 units or less, and we have essentially no authority to regulate those. Larger, we have some regulatory authority, and currently in Title 17, we require conditional use permits for where we allow those, and this implementation is to remove the conditional use permit requirement. So in the tables in Part 2 of Title 17, it would change the CU to a P, and that would mean either a land use permit if it qualified as a change of use, so like from a non-residential type to a residential type typically. For that specific site. But if it didn't rise to a change of use land use permit, then it would be exempt from a use permit. And then we have a request for reasonable accommodation. And this is an implementation for HE subprogram 3.1I. These are essentially reasonable accommodation requests are when someone seeks a deviation from our existing standards based on an individualized need for that accommodation. And there's various factors listed for the decision maker for those reasonable accommodations. The decision maker is listed as the director, unless there's a higher review authority attached to a project. But two of the factors were really open-ended. And as part of the housing element, one of the things we want to look at is certainty and clarity on procedures. And these two really kind of made it fairly open-ended as to whether a request would be granted or not. And so we flagged those two in the housing element, and so now we're following through by removing those two factors for consideration for reasonable accommodation requests. And we can go over the language, but they are pretty open-ended as they currently are written in Title 17. So then the third category is what we call minor revisions, and these are really more so the issues that we've really come across as we've processed under Title 17. It's still a young document, and this is really trying to fine-tune and identify issues and try to resolve them as we move along with processing. So the first item is our lot coverage methodology. So this will sound familiar. It's very similar to the residential density conversation we just had, where our lot coverage, when we think of lot coverage, I think as a planner you think of, you look at the whole space of the lot, and it's how much of that area can be covered, right? But the way we have it written right now in the code is it's based on net lot area. So you don't start with the whole lot. You actually start with the net lot area, and then a percentage of that could get developed on. And that certainly wasn't staff's intent. And so we think this is a revision worth making. And again, similar to that residential density, just because you can meet lot area using the gross lot or lot coverage standard using the gross lot, that doesn't mean you get to ignore all the other standards. All the other standards would still apply. So like we have different standards to serve different purposes. They will still be used. So that's it. Just because you meet the lot coverage doesn't mean you're guaranteed to build that size if you're running into conflict with something like a setback or an ESHA buffer. Those would still apply. But we think this is really an unnecessary limitation. We're proposing to, in the proposed ordinance, to clean that up. The next item is maximum floor area in the single family residential district. As part of Title 17, we incorporated an ordinance from 2006 based on, it's essentially kind of a sliding scale floor area standard in the single family residential district. It's similar to floor area ratio, but it's not quite because it's not a ratio. But in the 06 ordinance, which we meant to carry over really verbatim, we kind of dropped a word in terms of our adding accessory structures into that overall calculation. And the intent was it to be habitable structures. So the standard is really meant to regulate the habitable area on a site. So it wouldn't include something like a shed. We're proposing to add back in that habitable, just the word habitable, into that standard to match the old ordinance, which is really the intent when we moved forward. The next item is bus stops and setbacks. This is something we've come across in a couple projects recently where often bus stops are in the right of way, but occasionally they get developed on the private property as part of a development, perhaps a mitigation as part of the development to support public transit. There is nothing in our code that actually allows that currently to be on the private property within the setback at least. And presumably it's gonna be in a front setback. There's nothing in the code to allow it. So we're proposing basically an exception from front and street side setbacks really narrowly written for MTD bus stops that meet their design standards. And that's something that City Public Works was involved in the development of that document a while ago. It's posted online. And so it's kind of what you would expect to see from an MTD bus stop. So we want to do this narrow so that there weren't any unintended consequences. So it's written very narrow for that purpose. But we think that's a worthwhile addition because it does come up occasionally for projects. And we want to have at least an avenue for those structures to get developed. The next item is grading and grubbing. So there's some triggers for different permit requirements currently in the grading and grubbing section close to protected resources. That term isn't really defined, but we see that as really protecting like archaeological cultural resources. But now that we have a cultural resources chapter in our code, we think this those references to protected resources for the grading and grubbing triggers should be removed, as it's really the cultural resources section is where we look to how we protect those resources. And so it's kind of a duplicative, potentially conflicting section at this point, or reference at this point. So next up is notification of enlarged stream site protection areas. So this is actually an implementation of our creek and watershed management plan. And basically, we wanted to have some provision somewhere in our regulations to address where we have restoration projects, whether it's for a city project or as part of a large development, that will enlarge our stream site protection areas, or it will enlarge the area that qualifies as the stream site protection area from which we would measure off of that buffer essentially. And so we wanted to make sure we had some kind of trigger somewhere that we will notify property owners when that area is getting enlarged so that they are aware of the reduced development potential on their site. Because sometimes if it's the property owner where the restoration is occurring may well be aware of it, but those increased ESHA essentially will then impact the neighboring property and potentially several properties over. So we wanted to have some kind of mechanism to at least alert them so that they're aware of what's happening, so that they're not surprised later when there's a potential conflict with our ESHA protections in the zoning code. The next item is story poles. And so currently, story poles have to be erected before the first public hearing for a project, and there's nothing in the code to say you can remove them. So they essentially have to stay up from before that first hearing until after the project has been approved, denied, resolved in one way or another. And that creates some challenge for applicants because something like conceptual review, where there's not even a decision being made, that's a hearing. So they have to, right now, they have to put those story polls up before that first conceptual hearing. And there may be a significant lag between that conceptual and then coming back for project approval. Often applicants want to come in early for conceptual to get a sense of, is this project supportable the way we envision it? After that, they might actually work up design, engineering, go through the CEQA process. So it could take a long time before they come back for that for a final hearing on the project. And so what we proposed, and also we want to make sure it's a good thing to come in for conceptual so that they get a sense for how the design review board feels about a project. So we don't want to discourage them from coming in because they have to do this process. So what we proposed is to allow the removal immediately prior to any hearing where a decision is not made on the project. So conceptual is not like a formal decision. It's often kind of comments are provided and then they can move on. So that means they could bring them, take down the story polls and then go through the planning process. And then when we get to a hearing again, they would have to put them back up. So it still would require potentially multiple times. They don't have to take them down. They could keep them up. But so, you know, it still creates, there's still a fair burden on the applicant here. But at least it gives some relief from having to keep them up and maintain them. And then one of the other reasons why it makes sense to allow them to remove them is if conceptual leads to changes in design, then what's up is not even what they're proposing. But they don't want to put that up then because it could still change and it still could be months, maybe even years away from going to hearing for the project. So it really, if anything, it could be really misleading to have those story polls up for a long time. So those are some of the considerations there. The next step is development thresholds for substantial conformity determinations. So in a previous round of amendments, we tweaked some of the development thresholds. And so these thresholds are really determining, do you qualify for a substantial conformity determination, which is kind of a lower level process, or do you have to go up to like an amendment or essentially a new development plan? And so we inadvertently removed two of the thresholds the way the ordinance was written, just a couple little words, kind of tweaked inadvertently and actually removed these. And so we're bringing forth the fourth threshold, which has to do with the location of the structures. And the way the ordinance is proposed, that fifth threshold is not included, and that has to do with whether the project was subject to substantial controversy. And so we suggested not including that, just because it's pretty far from an objective standard that we could provide guidance to an applicant, at the counter as to what the process is for the project. However, it does have a benefit. That language can be beneficial so that staff isn't put in a position to have to do a staff level approval of something that drew a lot of controversy when it originally was approved. So our recommendation is not to re-include it, but that's something for Planning Commission to consider, whether that substantial controversy language should be added back in as a threshold. The next item is single unit dwelling lots and development plans. So this is a kind of a complication of some development plans. Often you'll see larger residential projects processed under a development plan, and that's for ease of going through the process. We do CEQA at once. There's a lot of reasons why that might make sense. But it creates a problem. Oftentimes those projects will have individual single-family lots, but the development plan is for the whole development. So if someone on a single-family lot wants to come in and make an addition to their house or something like that, well, it doesn't really make sense for them to amend the whole development plan. It's not really theirs. It's the whole development. And so it kind of creates this complication of how do we process that? And so what we proposed was kind of a unique procedure for those individual single unit dwelling lots where we would process them essentially as if there's not a development plan. So often like an addition to a single family dwelling may be exempt, maybe a land use permit, go to DRB, et cetera. However, there's a little concern we have with that without looking at the development plan, because the development plan may have some development limitations because of the overall impact of the project. So say the zone allows 35 feet, but this part of the development plan's only allowed to be 25 feet because of some environmental impact, right? So the way we wrote it is you don't have to treat it like an amendment or SCD or something to the development plan, because that individual lot doesn't really control, doesn't single-handedly control that development plan. But you would process it like you would any other development, as if it was there was no development plan. But we would still check the development plan to ensure consistency with any standards in that development plan. So we don't want to lose that thread of the development plan, but we wanted to create a process where they could propose to do things on their lot that isn't inconsistent with that approval. So we think that makes sense. It took us a while to get there. But we think it's a necessary improvement for those property owners. And then the final category is really what we think are really just minor cleanups, just like typos and that kind of thing. So there's a variety of them. They're in bullet form in the staff report. We can talk about any of them if you have any questions, but just wanted to highlight a few things. Removal of gender pronouns. So as far as we can tell, this round would remove all gender pronouns from Title 17. And then just some formatting improvements and procedural clarifications. So kind of, clearing up some ambiguity, but where the intent is clear, but we think there's just some minor refinements that were necessary. For CEQA, we always have to look at CEQA, California Environmental Quality Act, for these amendments. And we identified multiple reasons why this ordinance is exempt from CEQA, including that it is not a project under CEQA and the CEQA guidelines. Also, there is no possibility of causing significant effect on the environment. And the impacts are already analyzed in general plan EIR. We're not proposing massive changes to kind of the overall structure of our community. These are really more fine-tuning and compliance with state law as it's already written in the government code. So that ends our presentation. Again, we're happy. We know there's a lot of material here. Some of it we have very little leeway on. Some of it we have more. We're happy to go into any more depth with any of these topic areas if you have any questions for us. Thank you.
Thank you. I will now turn to commissioner questions. Yes.
My question's for staff. It's about the possibility of local discretion for the supportive housing. Is the 50 unit something that was called out in state law as a suggestion, like baseline, or is that kind of an arbitrary number?
So, Commissioner Fullerton, the way the law is written is they say essentially the standard is 50, however, the 50 units or less, depending on like the last homelessness count in the community and based on the county or city population. So the city may include a policy or regulation to not include that standard. So it's essentially, it's not something we're obligated to do, the 50 or no 50. So it is purely our discretion, but essentially it's set up in a way to give us, the baseline is 50 or less is ministerial, but this local jurisdiction can choose to either bump that up. So, we have kind of multiple options. We could make it just a higher number or just stay silent and so that all supportive housing is processed ministerially.
How many units was the Super 8 project?
I believe it was 60.
That sounds right, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Other commissioner questions? Commissioner Maynard.
So you had said earlier that, two questions, sort of just a context question to set the scope of tonight's meeting. So we have sort of three sets of edits, and one of the sets of edits is specifically related to the housing element. But Ms. Wells, you also talked about how the housing element is not agendized tonight. So can you help me get a sense of what we can talk about in terms of the housing element and what we shouldn't talk about? Let me just start there.
Thank you, Vice Chair Maynard. You can talk about anything that you want to talk about. Okay. But as far as a general plan amendment, mm-hmm. the housing element is a general plan amendment. So we're talking about Title 17. So if the change is, that's a different action. That's a different discretionary action. So that's why I mentioned that.
Okay. That's helpful.
And I would just add, we have some implementations in our housing element that call for Title 17 amendments that we didn't include in this packet, because we saw this packet as being like the very straightforward, this is what we have to do set of amendments. I'd use an example that we're going to revisit our parking standards. But that is a little trickier, and so we didn't feel it was appropriate to put in this packet, because this housing element implementation packet is really intended to be, this is what we got to do.
Okay. So I guess one broader question, which feel free to not to answer if it's not appropriate to do in this meeting then. So where are we in our housing elements? And it sounds like our last housing element we submitted was not approved. And what else do we need to sort of do to get to an approval on that?
That's a great question. And I think it does tie in with the packet, because we are implementing our housing element through these Title 17 amendments. But we adopted the housing, and the City Council adopted the housing element that the Planning Commission recommended. And so our old one's gone. We're implementing the new one. That's good, because our old one was old from 2014, really.
But it's not certified by the state?
It's not certified. So it's not approved, but certified. They gave us another letter on, I think, March 20th. It's on the city's website under advanced planning, under the housing element project. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a 5-page letter, and we're working through the changes now. And so you'll see that again. We'll return to you in the coming months soon to go over the revisions that we think are necessary to meet the state's requirements. It is a bit of a moving target, because the state evolves their expectations for housing element over time. Mm-hmm. So we'll be working with the state too on that, just like all the jurisdictions that are left with housing elements. Again, the state staggers the review of housing elements, so there's a group of us that are coming up next and that they're evaluating and analyzing. Mm-hmm. So more to follow on that, and soon is the plan.
And with having an uncertified housing element now, does that make us subject to more ministerial approved projects in this interim, or are we okay in the interim in terms of that?
I don't think we've had any, but there is a builder's remedy. It's possible. I don't know if Director Imhoff wants to expand on that, but there could.
Yeah, thank you, Chair and Commissioner Maynard. There isn't really much to add. I think Ms. Wallace has described that very thoroughly. The builder's remedy doesn't apply at this point, because there are certain criteria that are not in place. For example, there are water limitations that have not yet been lifted. But certainly we're moving as quickly as we can to address the state's comments. And as Ms. Wells said, we'll be bringing revisions back through the Planning Commission and Council. And we're, of course, working in consultation with the State Department of Housing and Community Development to understand their comments and to make sure that the revisions that we bring back to you address their concerns. So stay tuned.
Okay. That's very helpful. Thank you. LU 2.2. So this was one where in the staff report we analyzed it, to say that we think we can be consistent with the general plan. My read of it, it seems like the intent of it was to keep the density a little bit lower if you also had Escher or other constraints to be in there. What are the pros and cons to editing the general plan? Like, if I could see both arguments. I could see an argument that we could argue for consistency, but it seems at least that the intent was to try to restrict the density, and so an update to that seems useful to me. But what are the drawbacks and the implications if we try to say that there should be a general plan amendment to allow the change to LU 2.2?
Commissioner Maynard, I think there's a procedural and timeline implications. It could be something that could be revisited in the future, but we think because there is enough flexibility, and we put in the findings that staff believes we have enough flexibility in that language to move forward, because we think this is a really important thing to clarify in our zoning regulations, that it's really valuable to get that in place in the near term. But it's certainly something we can kind of look at that policy moving forward, but we still do feel like we have just enough flexibility now to amend Title 17.
And I'll add to that there's some gray area, and we are choosing to And when we adopted the housing element to work with that gray area, because it's so important to our site's inventory, to make sure that the density calculated can be, for example, there was in the staff report, there was an example used for a development. You could get the same development footprint with bigger houses or with smaller houses in the same footprint. And so that's why we're working with the gray area, is so that we can get hopefully, you know, more units in that same development footprint, not just bigger ones.
There was a public comment letter that got into streetlights. And I guess the question that I had, and I read this very quickly before the meeting because the public comment letter came in today, so I'm hoping I'm understanding this correctly, but it sounded like in the comment they had described that if a streetlight was required by a project, it might not be consistent with the NZO. Do streetlights exempted from NZO lighting guidelines? Can you talk to more to that?
Yeah, we'll have to look into that. We're aware of sports field lighting. And the city council went through our work program, and they prioritized, and you know, certain things, including looking at lighting as it relates to sports field. And so that's coming as a future work item. For the streetlights, we really haven't looked at what is in which title of the Goleta Municipal Code applies for streetlights. But I don't think they're in Title 17. But I, you know, wouldn't want it on the fly answer with any kind of assurance, because we haven't broken that down. And I don't know if anyone else here at staff has, but.
That's sufficient for now. My last question is on bus stops. And did you consider school buses? And you want to make it narrow, so we focused on the MTD. But have you considered school buses as a part of that?
Commissioner Maynard, we haven't, because you know, the MTD was the issue. But you know, we'd certainly welcome feedback on that. I don't know what kind of structures they have, if it would qualify as structures in development under Title 17, where certainly the MTD kind of, you know, with the benches and the kind of the walled off and maybe awning area is more certainly structural development regulated under Title 17. But yeah, we did not think about that.
That's all for now.
Any other commissioner questions? Commissioner Chapman.
Thank you. One question I have about the emergency shelters, the provision of the hours of operation. You said that was something that was permissive. It wasn't necessarily a regulation. If it was to allow 24 hours of operation, correct?
That's correct, Commissioner Chapman. And there's nothing in the law kind of giving us that guidance to limit the hours of operation. So, by you know, it's not really something listed as something we can regulate. And we're just saying it may operate 24 hours. And it's not like a requirement of any kind. So we didn't think that was appropriate to keep in.
Thank you. Another question about the bus stops. Are those subject to an independent design review, or is that something that utilizes a standard design?
Commissioner Chapman, they utilize a standard design. So MTD publishes, I think in the regulation we use the title of that document. It's a document listed on their post on their website, and it gets into pretty fine detail about exactly what those stops need to look like, and it gets down into like font sizes and all that kind of detail.
Thank you. One more question. It is kind of maybe more broadly about the intent of the existing zoning code. It is the difference between the lot coverage regulation and the maximum floor area. I think it makes sense to have those be calculated, especially the lot coverage to be calculated the same as density. What is the reason for both of those, and do they interact at all?
Commissioner Chapman, they kind of, we have various types of standards for different zones. So like in the RS zone, currently we don't have a lot coverage standard, so we rely on this overall floor area standard. So it's just regulated a little bit differently, and that's a historical decision. So that goes back to our general plan adoption and this ordinance in 06, and that's kind of the way we've been practicing. And, you know, we haven't seen a reason to change course, you know, if nothing else. And so, like, you'll see in the general plan, in the land use element, some zones or some land use designations in the general plan have lot coverage requirements. So we carry those forward into the zoning code. And then in RS, and again, that, you know, it kind of deals a little bit with more like FAR. So it's really like the overall volume of the structures, where a lot coverage is really on the 2D plane. And then to deal with volume, you have your setbacks and your height standards. And then design review may limit it a little further. But for the most part, the lot coverage standard doesn't get as much into that kind of volume massing as floor area, total floor area may.
Thank you. That's all for now.
I had a question about the live work changes. And I'm just sort of kind of wrapping my head around the big picture here, because my understanding is the proposal is to remove a minor conditional use permit in certain zones, and I guess I'm just wrapping my head around are rules in place such that, I guess I'm thinking about a concept where something really ends up looking like a living project, a residential project. I'm just wondering if people would sort of try to almost like potentially get around other standards and other zones to get more of a residential type of development in the commercial areas, if the standard is too low.
So Chair Smith, one of the things we actually removed, one of the standards, was there currently in Title 17, there's a standard that live work unit must contain a residential use but are not required to maintain a work or commercial use, so that you could actually like kind of. And we propose to remove that as one of the fine tunings of this regulation. Mm-hmm. So under live work, you have to have, under the definition of the use, you have to have a non-residential component. We included this amendment. We just see it as a valuable different type of use. We haven't seen a lot of it. We got some on the Winslow project. There are some live work units. So that's the first time we've seen it. But we just think with potential changes in work behavior that this may be something that will be a benefit. But the way the use is defined to qualify as live work, you would have to operate the non-residential component. In Title 17, the use is listed as a commercial use. Like, we kind of have envisioned this as a commercial use. But that edit, we think, is in part to try to tackle that issue of it really being kind of snuck in as more of a residential use.
And I'll add that the non-residential use still has to be on the first floor. So as far as the character goes, it will still be consistent with the zoning the way it is now.
Okay. Commissioner Maynard had a follow-up on this question.
I'm curious about how we define the commercial portion of that use. So I know we sort of envisioned this with the Winslow project being live-work, but like I actually live very close to that project, so I've gone and sort of walked around there. I don't know if it's just the impact of COVID, but there's very few storefronts in that project. So I think there's probably commercial uses, but it might be somebody working from home or a writer. It doesn't appear to be a lot of forefront customer engagement. This is very anecdotal, but I'm kind of curious, like, how do we define commercial, and does it need to be accessible to the public, or just a general business type? That's my thoughts on that.
Commissioner Maynard, the way the live works specific use standards are written, the non-residential use has to be permitted outright or allowed with a land use permit. So essentially, whatever zone that's in, that non-residential use has to be a use that is allowed in that zone. So if it's, depending on what type of zone it is, there may be one that doesn't have a lot of client interaction, but whatever it is, it has to fit with our what we otherwise allow in that zone without the live portion. So like if it was a standalone use that didn't require a lot of public interaction, we would still allow it. The idea here is the live work use wouldn't change the character of the non-residential uses in that zone.
Thank you. And I know it wasn't directly addressed in the proposed changes today, but we did receive a comment about agricultural zoning, and I just thought I would raise. We do have a local ordinance, right, related to zoning of agriculture, correct? That limits what the city has authority to do that requires public approvals for changes.
Chair, I think you're referring to Measure G that was passed by the voters.
Yes. So I couldn't recall if that got incorporated into ordinance or how that appears.
It's in the general plan.
Okay. I just wanted to flag that item in terms of a constraint. I don't have any other questions. Is there anything, any other just clarifying questions at this time from commissioners? Okay. Well, with that, we'll move to public comment. And in terms of our usual procedure is that we have a 3-minute public comment period. How should we proceed in terms of in-person versus any remote comments?
We can take the in-person first if you'd prefer, and then move on to the Zoom webinar people on hold.
Perfect. And so we'll go ahead and proceed with public comment.
Okay. Just as a reminder for any attendees on the webinar, if you can please use the raise hand feature and we will call you shortly. Thank you. At this time, we do have Beth Collins on behalf of Kim Shizes.
Chair, commissioners, I'm Beth Collins. I represent Kim Shizes and Mark Linehan, whom I think you may well know. They actually found a cleanup issue that they would like your consideration to add to these packet of cleanup items, and this one has to do with light trespass. And you received my letter, it sounds like. Currently, decision makers do have the discretion to customize with respect to height, lot coverage, building setbacks, parking, landscaping, screening, but that is not true for lighting. There's just a hard standard at the spillover of 0.1 candles at the property line. This is a fixed standard, and that's actually a problem for a number of reasons. And I'm here on behalf of Kim and Mark, but honestly, I represent a ton of property owners that I think that this would impact. And you all are super familiar with this. There are all sorts of reasons why you give out mods. Sometimes it's impossible. And in the circumstance of light, you mentioned Commissioner Maynard, the streetlight situation, there may be other reasons that the spillover at the property line could be impossible. Other reasons for safety, requirements that are in the code or OSHA. Also, you're familiar, I remember watching you all deliberate on West Star, and you're familiar with the fact that different parcel lines on commercial projects, different residential projects, they're divided up for financing purposes, but you don't experience the property as a real parcel line, but to have that fixed standard at those parcel lines could lead to some problematic unintended consequences. So we're asking you all to trust yourselves and decision makers to kind of customize that light standard for each project. And, you know, I fully understand staff may tell you that, you know, now's not the right time. It's not been before you. It's not been analyzed. But I will tell you, we have a project right now. It's a health clinic that we're concerned that this is going to impact the processing of, and I think it would also impact Gersh Park and some other projects in the pipeline. So if we can't deal with it today, I ask that it be expedited as soon as possible to be addressed as a cleanup item. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
And Ms. Collins, you did indicate that you submitted two speaker slips if you wanted to come up once more. And this was on behalf of various business owners.
So, Chair, Commissioners, hi, me with another hat on, representing other folks in the community. And I have a number of housing clients here in Goleta, a number of landowners that I represent. In general, we're supportive of the zoning changes. Thank you, staff, for putting them forward. We really appreciate it. Even with these changes, however, more changes are needed, and it sounds like staff knows that very well. For example, we'd love to see more options for by right development on property in Goleta. We've also mentioned the housing element. I mentioned that in my letter. Two requests, and I understand the housing element's not before you, but as Ann mentioned, it's coming soon. So I'm hopeful that you can, I'm trying to plant the seed and not sandbag and show up at the last minute. I wanna, you know, show up early and give you all the heads up that there are a couple of requests. One, there are some real opportunities where the underutilized sites in the city can be converted to housing, but some of them are identified like for densities like 12 units per acre, and frankly that's just not high enough density to incentivize property owners to convert to housing. I did put a couple of addresses in my letter, which I'm sure Ms. Wells noted, so we ask respectfully that those sites be considered for rezone and at higher densities than are currently there. Also, wanted to flag that some vacant sites really need to be included, in our opinion, the housing element. Commissioner Smith mentioned ag. Specifically, the Shelby and Kenwood sites are currently zoned ag. But they are not subject to Measure G, just so that you know that. Kenwood has a couple of acres of ag, so that's exempted. And then Shelby actually has a vested map and is therefore Measure G does not apply. These properties also haven't been used for ag in decades. They're surrounded by non-agricultural uses. Due to the size and the soils and the setting, they are actually totally inappropriate for ag. And they're not the type of ag that Measure G was envisioned to really protect. So we're asking that both those sites be included on the rezone list. They already have full EIRs prepared, EIRs that have been processed. There's also an EIR prepared for the rezone of these sites to residential already. So these are the closest to shovel ready of any project in Goleta right now. And I'm gonna say one more sentence and then sit down. So these sites are poised to be developed in this next cycle into housing. And so we ask that you consider including it in your housing element. Thank you.
Thank you.
We do have two speakers on the Zoom app. If Steve Fort, if you can please unmute yourself.
All right, I think I'm unmuted, correct?
Correct.
All right, thank you. Hi, Steve Fort. I'm with Suzanne Ellidge, Planning and Permitting. And I'm speaking tonight as a senior planner with Theft, and also based on experience with multiple current future clients and even some clients we've had in the past. And also based on, you know, discussions with other land use consultants and design professionals from the AIA, and even certain DRB members, I'm aware, are supportive of consideration of the amendments to the story pole requirements. I should have been clear at the start that I'm speaking to the story pole requirement. We appreciate the proposal put forth by staff to allow story poles to be taken down and not have to stay up throughout the entitlement process. We think that is, we fully support that, and it's actually absolutely critical because, excuse me, sorry, I'm going through my notes here. You know, in some cases, leaving them up, and in many cases, leaving them up isn't desirable or practical. You know, there can be some unmanageable conflicts at the sites where they're required to go up. That can create problems with the operations of an existing facility or an institution or a business. You know, it can conflict with parking and circulation, deliveries, customers, client safety, maintaining the site. They can become unsightly over time. So we fully support that, and we hope that you move that forward to have the ability to remove the story poles. And actually, kind of along the lines of what Beth was saying, we hope that in the future we'll even continue consider going a little bit further and letting staff come back to you with some additional discretion with regard to story poles, and hopefully, you know, not even having to put them back up after that initial time that they go up. You know, we're hoping for some more discretion for staff for when story poles are actually required, and also we'd like to see some flexibility of, hey, we'll put them up, we'll take photos of them, we'll photo document them, we'll have the eventual decision makers come out to the site. We just think it's kind of burdensome and perhaps unnecessary to have to put them back up. But again, in closing, we fully support the ability to remove them, and we hope in the future that staff and decision makers we'll consider even further discretion about when they go up, whether they have to go back up, and how they could potentially be documented for future reference. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And our next speaker is Cecilia Brown. If you can please unmute yourself.
Good evening, Madam Chair, Commissioners. I got a wonderful email from Ann Wells who kind of woke me up out of my summer slumber here working in the garden to speak on a couple of the issues before you tonight. But I do want to speak about story poles. I think, as many of you know, or maybe you don't, I was a longtime planning commissioner with the County of Santa Barbara. I've been on the design review board for a number of years. And so I'm very, very familiar about story poles and their importance. And I'm glad to see the city, which never had any, wrote some standards during the NZO hearing. I would concur with Steve Ford that you really don't need to maintain them throughout the long process from the design review board meetings until other discretionary review hearings. What you need to do is to take photos of these things, and that documentation should be in your ordinance, so that if you miss them and they're not reinstated, you can see what the story poles tell you. Story poles are about noticing anyway. And I do think that it is a burden for the applicant. I follow a lot of projects in the city, and so I'm familiar with these story poles. And I do think that even under maintenance, applicants shouldn't be required to make story poles. I think this is really for the design review board to see what the story poles are, just about size, bulk, and scale, and some other issues. It's really more of the land use when it comes to you. So I would concur that there needs to be photo documentation. I think once they're up for the design review board hearings, I don't think they need to be maintained. I think it's up to the applicant if they want to do that, but they shouldn't be. Anyway, and I'll speak on lighting. And anyway, thank you. Best wishes to you all.
If there are additional speakers on Zoom, would you please use the raise hand feature and I will call on you. I do not see any responses.
Thank you. Okay, if there are no further speakers, we will close the public comment period and we will move into, I guess, were there any follow-up questions based on public comment that commissioners had for staff? If not, then we'll move into our commissioner deliberations. I'm not sure how commissioners, if you want to look at it globally or if there's any particular areas that you wanted to call out for any item of discussion. Commissioner Fullerton.
Thank you. The only thing really I wanted to comment about going back to the supportive housing, I think it's fine to leave it open-ended, not knowing, you know, I think we want to encourage those kind of projects. So putting a limit of 50 seems a little bit arbitrary to me. So I'm supportive of not putting a limit, but if we did want to do a limit, maybe go a little higher, 75 or 100, just because maybe we could get another project like the one that we already had. As for the public comment on the lighting, I don't feel comfortable doing anything about that tonight until staff has a chance to review and also like design review board, I know has in the past looked into lighting and having a lighting expert look at that. So I don't feel comfortable doing anything on that as well as the other suggestions. I think we need time for staff to review that, but it sounds like we are going to have more opportunities to make changes in the future, so I think that would be more appropriate. Otherwise, I'm supportive of all the changes. I don't have any other comments.
Yes, Commissioner Chapman.
Yeah, I have a couple comments on a couple of specific items as well. When it comes to the supportive housing, I think I agree to keep it open-ended in that this is a critical need, and you know if they meet the standards, especially considering that the city has endorsed the Buena Terra project, which is over that 50 unit threshold. I think if we were to determine a threshold for any reason, we would want to figure out what that would be and why. I have a comment about the changes to the substantial conformity determinations. That was section B of that section. Section A, in regards to changes to an existing zoning permit, has the exact same language, whether something's been subject to a significant controversy. So if that is, if we don't want it in one section because it's, you know, too open-ended, we would maybe want to revisit anywhere else that would appear as well, so that we could use something more objective if that's what we want to do. That's all for now. Thank you.
Commissioner Maynard.
Commissioner Chapman, what was that second section where you saw the controversy language?
It was section A in regards to changes to an existing zoning permit.
I want to go take a look at that one again. The couple of comments that I have, I think I would consider a school bus stop in the setback, especially near schools. I know we've used the school bus stops on campus, which is not in Goleta, but it's been really helpful in places where we have school tours visiting the campus or near museum sites on the campus. And so having opportunities for school buses to stop in front can be really helpful. So that might be something to consider for school sites. I think the staff did a great job with the story polls change, and I would recommend supporting what staff proposed on story polls, but not going further with it. I do think the story polls are powerful, not just for decision makers, but also for the public. and more of the public comes out during the Planning Commission City Council processes than the DRB process. So I like having the story polls still up when the Planning Commission goes. So I think the what staff recommends on story polls is an appropriate scaling of that. I would recommend keeping supportive housing without a limit. I agree that lighting would need further review before I would recommend changes on it. Though some interesting comments came up in the public comment that maybe were staff bringing more information back to us for consideration. Going to lighting mods, you know, I went to the Planning Commission conference recently, and it seems like the signals we're getting is a very strong signal towards objectifying everything, moving everything to objective standards rather than subjective standards and mods. And so I think as we're thinking about the lighting, rather than trying to add more modification routes, trying to think through the objective standards to address the types of concerns that are coming up. But I think the modification process kind of brings us back to the subjective place. And so I think we just have to get smarter with the objective standards. And I guess on LU 2.2, I still feel like we're inconsistent with the intent, but I'm also sensitive to the timeline. So if it would delay our ability to get the housing elements certified, then I say we go with the gray area. But if it can be done in the time period that we're waiting for other things anyway, then I'd rather see also updated in the general plan. So I like the direction you're going, but I think the intent of the general plan, LU 2.2, seems inconsistent with the direction we're going, but the letter of the law and the exactly what it says, I do agree we have wiggle there. So I guess I'm trying to get a sense of timing, and because I don't want to support something that would delay certification of the general of the housing element. I know that was kind of vague, so let me know if you need me to clarify more.
Thank you. I'll just comment that I'm generally, you know, supportive of the proposed changes. I wanted to thank staff for, a well-organized report and presentation to help us understand these various categories of changes. That was very helpful to me. And the part that stood out were the net versus gross calculations. I mean, I think it raises I think an interesting question about what the city is facing in this current housing cycle, and what strikes me as an approach where as we're looking at meeting our regional housing needs and looking at ways that we can really get where there are, you know, proposed developments, you know, the opportunity to maximize the use in those spaces. So it seems, you know, consistent with that approach in terms of what the areas that we already have zoned in certain ways, that looking at those calculations is a way that we can maximize what's being done in those places. I'll be perfectly honest that I don't, at least in my experience as a planning commissioner, and my sense of the perspective of our city council is that I don't see. And especially being this far along in our housing element process, I don't see rezone of even smaller agricultural parcels as being one that's going to pass, for this community that has spoken very strongly on those issues. It may need to be revisited down the line, but I don't anticipate that this council will take that up, but that I think that you know, I think that issue being part of the housing element is ultimately a sort of a policy decision for the council to decide. But I don't see that happening this cycle. And I actually agree. I think the story polls, even already, at least as a commissioner, I'm seeing on I think as commissioners, we like the story polls, because what I'm seeing, even from the ones that have already gone up, is ensuring that the public is more aware of what's happening, what's being proposed at earlier stages. So often the public comes to us, and it's not even until something's being built that they say, "Wow, I didn't even know that there was this project happening." And even if I tell them about all the different ways to sign up and get alerts, right? We're all busy. We have our lives. And so it's really an easy way to help the public be engaged. But obviously we want to have a balanced approach. The question of photos is an interesting one, but I think we may need to, that may come back maybe at a future revision. I don't feel like I have enough maybe information on that question or how we can strike the right balance, but I do think they are very helpful for the public to become educated and informed at early stages of the process. So I'm both supportive of story polls in general and then supportive of the changes. And I'm sure as there may be more lessons learned, because the only other thing that crossed my mind was, if going up and down could get confusing, or I don't know, to the public or to the applicant, but until it actually happens, I'm not sure if we'll know how it'll actually work out in practice. I think those are all my comments. Any other comments? Commissioner Chapman.
Thank you, Chair Smith. So I also would like to comment on LU 2.2. My interpretation of that is that that it doesn't necessarily state an intent that to limit the density through something like the lot area calculation. I think personally, it's stating that those densities are not guaranteed, and other regulations may inhibit those, such as scenic corridors, our streamside protection buffers, the ESHA buffers, and any of the other problems listed. I think that we could be more explicit if there were concerns about densities associated with the things on the list, and that we would cover through other regulations. I'm not sure if the net versus gross floor, area was even considered as a way to limit that. I'm not sure the history of that. Maybe you could clarify that. And then I would also like to comment on the story polls. I think one possible compromise could be if they don't want to take them up and down again. I think that they are much more informative than a lot of other information channels. Unfortunately, public engagement is very difficult, and those get noticed a lot more than anything else. And I think one thing you could potentially do is perhaps have a minimum duration that they're up. If they're only going to go up once, maybe something like a month, and trying to strike that balance between them being something that is there for a long time, something difficult to maintain, and something that become an eyesore. I think people get sick of seeing them at a certain point, but potentially there could be a compromise there. But for now, I do agree with going forward with as written, of at least they can come down if an official determination hasn't been made. That's all. Thank you.
Commissioner, Vice Chair Maynard.
So I was on Planning Commission when we were talking about net versus gross, and my remembrance from many years ago is that we actually chose the way that it is in the zoning ordinance to be consistent with architectural practice. So it wasn't intended to shift development or density as much it was to stay consistent with architectural practice at the time. So I don't know if we've looked at that, but that was my remembrance of why we did it, if it's helpful. Also, in response to what Commissioner Chapman had brought up earlier about 1752-100, where we were talking about substantial conformity determination, which is B, and you mentioned A, the zoning permit, and minor changes to an approved or issued zoning permit may be allowed in different circumstances, and then under A1G, it references that substantial public controversy note again. And I do think, given the move to objective design standards, Commissioner Chapman has a point that we might remove that as well in that section. I guess a question to the other commissioners. So we've had some different viewpoints on LU 2.2, so I'm curious what our other commissioners think about that.
I don't have the language of LU 2.2 right in front of me.
Chair, would it assist if we provided the language of LU 2.2? Are we able to pull that up?
We're working on that right
okay.
now.
Okay, all right.
I guess I would just say, at least for tonight, I'm not, in reading that language, I don't have significant concern. Commissioner Fullerton?
No, I agree, and I also agree with Vice Chair Maynard about not wanting to affect the housing element and the timing on the housing element.
If there's no further comments, is there a motion? Oh, Commissioner Maynard has a question.
I think the only thing I recommended changing out of the staff was potentially changing MTD bus stops to MTD and school bus stops. I don't know if that's something you'd like to look into more, or if it would make sense to do that as a modification to the recommendation. And I guess I don't know if I got buy-in from the other commissioners on that one, but.
I'll just note that I'm not aware of, you know, it sounds like MTD, they have objective design, like an objective design standard. You know, there's been sort of this specific situation that has come up that, you know, staff is sort of trying to address. I mean, there might be a little bit of time for some consideration before council takes this up. So, but I think my only concern is, yeah, I just don't have a lot of information just on that question. Any of the other commissioners?
Yeah, I'm not sure if schools use bus shelters the same way that the fixed route buses do. I know that a lot of them actually utilize the MTD boosters, so that they would use those same stops. So I'm not really sure how often that would be applicable.
So does that work to staff to just leave that as a note for more research to consider, rather than putting part of the recommendation?
Not a problem. We can do that.
Okay. Then yes, I'm good moving forward.
I'm agreeable with that note, or kind of comment to staff. Anything else, Commissioner Fullerton?
I was going to say I'm ready to make a motion.
Okay.
Chair Smith, could I ask you to close the public hearing before we entertain a motion?
Yes, I will close the public hearing at this time, and we'll go to motion.
Okay, I'll motion to adopt Planning Commission Resolution Number 23- entitled A Resolution of the Planning Commission of the City of Goleta, California, recommending that the City Council adopt an ordinance to amend various sections of Title 17 of the Goleta Municipal Code and determine the ordinance to be exempt from the California Environmental Quality Act.
Is there a second?
I'll second.
Okay. Do we need to do a roll call vote?
That is not required since all members are present in chambers.
Okay. Wow, it's been so long. Okay, all commissioners in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed? Aye. Any abstentions? It passes unanimously with one absent. All right, thank you. And thank you to the members of the public for your comments and participation this evening. Next, we'll move to item C, which is our planning director's comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have an extensive report tonight. I did want to alert the commission that last week on Tuesday, the council took action on first reading to adopt a REACH code that would ban natural gas infrastructure and new construction going forward. However, the day prior on Monday, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals had issued an opinion in a similar case or dealing with a similar ordinance involving the city of Berkeley to invalidate that ordinance on the basis that it was preempted by federal law. So we are now evaluating that decision, and we will probably be thinking that through and waiting to see what happens there before we bring that item back on second reading. So that was big news last week. As you heard, we are continuing progress on our housing element revisions to address the state's comments, and that will be coming to you at a Planning Commission meeting soon, but we don't have a date yet. And our next meeting date will be May 8th, where we have just one item on the agenda relating to a consistency determination for our capital improvement program. So light agenda, it looks like, coming up on the 8th. That's it for me.
Thank you. And our next item are, well, I guess, does anybody have any questions for the director? And then do we have any Planning Commission comments? Commissioner Maynard.
Just a thank you to the city and staff for sending several of our planning commissioners to the Planning Commission Academy. It was a great experience. I learned a lot about new housing laws and also how those are being interpreted by different cities, how different cities are adapting and creating their housing elements, and had a lot of really great conversations that I hope to bring back some ideas in future meetings for us. But it was a very, very informative event, and I appreciate the city for sending us.
Yeah, I agree. It was a really interesting experience and a good crash course on a lot of the going on in the state and just how to be a better planning commissioner as well. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. If there are no further comments, we'll move to adjournment. Is there a motion for adjournment?
A motion.
Okay. Is there a second?
I'll second.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. We are adjourned. Thank you very much.